Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome and hello. This is Joseph G. with Rum Radio and rumradio.org, the most comprehensive 12-step sponsorship in the known and the unknown universe. As my sponsor likes to tell me, the unknown universe is the unseen universe. And sometimes I don't see very well, so there's a lot of it. I'd like to acknowledge WNAH. That would be Hoyt Carter and Tony the Horse, who affords us the opportunity to broadcast live to their listening audience in Nashville, parts of Kentucky and Alabama, as a public service presentation. We'd also like to acknowledge RecoveryToday.net magazine. It's one of the finer recovery journals, and they afford us some print space from time to time. I'd greatly like to introduce my co-host, Harold B., a family intervention specialist. He does a fine work with troubled families, and I believe the families are the basic unit of our society. And as the family goes, so does the nation. Harold?
Hello, everybody, and hello, Joseph. Hello, Larry. And it's nice to be here. I'd just like to take a minute and explain to our listeners that this is not a commercial venture. This is done as a public service. It's part of one of the ways that I give back. I've also taken the training to take recovery into the jails and prisons here in the Houston area. And Wednesday will be my first adventure in that way. A lot of people have come before me and are doing a great work there with thousands of inmates. And another way that I give back is through my work, and that's mostly family therapy. I help families with their parenting challenges and their marriage challenges. Difficulties, and that work is growing, and it's very, very rewarding indeed. I'm really honored to be working at the nicest counseling center in Houston. It's called the Houston Center for Christian Counseling, and that's a growing work, and I really appreciate that. I want to mention for a second that Joseph does this website and radio program as two of his ways of giving back, and it doesn't make him money. In fact, it costs quite a bit of money to keep this going. He insists on improving it all the time, and it has improved a lot. So that's rumradio.org, and you can go there and find more information about how to work with other people, because what I've found and what we've found is that working with other people is really the best way to maintain sobriety and build recovery and avoid relapse. And so he's spent thousands of dollars and really has over 100,000 hits in his in many countries. I'll let him explain how many countries and how many people are looking on the website. Listeners can also go to the website and listen to past programs there. Joseph has made that available free of charge, and I really admire that. So let's get on with our program, Joseph.
Thank you, Harold. Well, tonight we're going to have Larry Smith from Get Real Recovery. And he'll be talking with us. He's also a veteran, and today is Veterans Day, lest we forget. I think this is an important day. If we don't remember our veterans, it's like we're not remembering history, we're prone to repeat it again. Real warriors who've been in combat and in conflict will tell you one thing. They would prefer not to have done that. There's got to be an easier, softer way. But sometimes it's the only political solution, and these are the guys that go into harm's way. So this is really what makes the United States a powerful nation, is our military force. Make no mistake, that's the thing that keeps them, the barbarians, at the gate. So before we get into that, I want to say hello to Larry. And Larry, how you doing? You there?
Yes, I am, Joseph, and I listened to your intro there. That sounded really good. And first of all, I want to thank you guys for all the wonderful work you do in recovery and how much of your personal time and money that you put into to helping other people, and it does pay off. And also to the veterans out there, I salute you guys. I put a little post on Facebook today that I joined the military not out of love of country or patriotism. I enlisted when I was 17 years old because I was facing the draft, and I'm from a small town where a lot of guys were coming back in body bags, and I was pretty scared that would be me if I got drafted. So I kind of jumped the gun and got enlisted in the Air National Guard, trying to avoid much duty, and ended up loving the military and staying in for 23 years.
Thank you. We'll get into that a little bit more, but first I'd like to start the show on a spiritual note and some information. And part of it is about Rum Radio is really about sponsorship. That's how it started. That's the main thrust of rumradio.org, how to find a sponsor, how to find the sponsee, what a sponsor does and doesn't do, all the interactive questions. We go through the steps, a lot of good tools, a lot of good understanding, sponsorship techniques, understandings, and information from different parts of the world. Some people have really good information. They're only tools. How many guys have enough tools? You know, just put it in your Snap-on. You know, you'll never know when you might need a new tool. And that's the idea behind Rum Radio. And how to find a sponsee. A lot of people, they raise their hand in meetings, you know, and that's how we do it now. I consider that like a dating service, that there's only this one guy that's going to be able to take you, make you whole. So there's a spiritual connection. It works, having no other choice, but sometimes it works and works really well. There's a spiritual connection that should not be discounted. But on page 89 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it says, find a prospect or go get a prospect. I think it's go get a prospect and start working on him. It doesn't say have the prospect go find you. So my idea, I do it both ways, since the common understanding is how to find a sponsor. So I go there, and it's also how to find the sponsee. Go get the guy and start working on him, because the one immunity we have from alcohol is intensive work with another alcoholic. This activity works when others' activities fail. So it's as simple as it gets. It's a simple program for very complicated people. So we try to keep it simple. We don't have to keep it stupid. But simple is really the key to long-term recovery, I believe. So when I'm looking for a sponsee, I prepare myself. And one of the things I do is I carry around Clancy I's 7 questions. Clancy I is sort of an icon in the recovery community. He's an old-timer now. No telling how old he is. I would guess probably middle 80s. He's a crusty kind of guy. I've been pushed off. You know, I've given him Rum Radio cards, and he's kind of flipped it off a couple times. He's got really good information. He's got a really good – you either love Clancy or you hate Clancy, but Clancy's he's good. Got a good program, great speaker. And he's developed 7 questions for the newcomer or the relaxer, you know, that you need to get a kickstart him. And these 7 questions are found on the websites under how to find a sponsee. So when I'm looking for a sponsee, I prepare myself. So I believe luck is no more than when preparation meets opportunity. You prepared in that opportunity will be manifest. I'm kind of from the school, when the teacher is ready, the student will appear. So after we usually have a prayer at the end of a meeting, of a recovery meeting, it's the Lord's Prayer, the Third Step Prayer, or the Serenity Prayer. One of the, you know, it's like a benediction. We close in thankfulness that we had the time and to be together, and it's very spiritual. I believe recovery meetings are all gratitude meetings, and an attitude of gratitude is a prayer unto God. And so when we circle up, if there's a newcomer who just got his beginner's chip or desire chip, it's a little medallion, a little aluminum disc that has the same color as handcuffs, and it says, "To thy known self be true," and then it's an outward sign of an inward commitment to try our way of life for 24 hours, that you won't drink for 24 hours. Can you do it? Just 24 hours, give it a try, one day at a time. I grab hands with this guy, and then after we say the prayer, I turn around to him immediately and say, "Have you had enough?" If he has had enough, he'll know what I'm talking about. Sometimes I'll get, "What do you mean enough? Enough humiliation, enough pain, enough degradation. Have you had enough?" Yes. "Are you willing to go to any length to achieve sobriety? Yes or no?" Yes. They're going to say this. They're not telling me particularly, but I need to hear that. They're also telling themselves that they're making these commitments. And then they say, "Okay, first thing I need, you can get well from this disease of mind, body, and spirit, but there's certain things you have to do. And the first thing I need you to do is to answer these," and I pull them out, "Clancy's 7 questions. I need these answered, and I need them back tomorrow. Not the day after tomorrow, not the, my dog ate my homework. I need them back tomorrow. Here's my number. I expect your call." And that's my last interaction with the guy unless he calls. I don't call him and find out what happened to him or if there's a problem. If I get the call, he's done the work, he's into action and is taking simple instruction, and then we get started right away. And then one of the first assignments I give him is to get a beginner's packet if he hadn't gotten it on his first meeting, or get a list of men's names, men with men, women with women. We find this to be the most productive. The key is to work the steps when possible. Try to do the same gender, because we can relate better to that, and there's less chance because of the intimacy of being inappropriate. So we get started that way and get a list of men's names, maybe 20 or 30 names if possible. Have the fellow come in early to the meeting the next day if possible. Give it to the chairperson, ask them to get the names, people who would volunteer their phone numbers, and that's readily usually available to them. And for the next 30 days, call one of the fellows on the list and ask permission to recite the third step prayer to them. Now, I tell them to do that for several reasons. One is it gets them used to picking up the 500-pound telephone and asking for help. Most people don't like to do that. And so that gets them used to picking up the phone. It connects them up in their home group, because now, you know, they're looking at a home group that's their extended family and their lifeline. So they're getting to know his name, and they're getting to know his name, and they're getting to know your name, etc. So the third reason is that the third step prayer, I also call the surrender prayer, it gives them an idea of what we're going to try to accomplish by working all 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. You got to remember, this isn't AA. We don't represent Alcoholics Anonymous. This is Rum Radio. The big book of Alcoholics Anonymous is the basic text, is the template for all 12-step recovery. Like it or not, that's it. The 12 steps that came out of that is the template. And I believe anytime you change a template and you make a copy, something's added, something's changed, and something's lost. So I like to use the primary text. This is what works the best. This is what worked for me. This is what will work for you. So when he calls that, and then the fourth reason is the fella he's calling might have been thinking about taking his first drink of alcohol, and chances are he will not do that. I've heard stories that we have no guarantees in this thing, but your sponsee is already doing a service work by doing this, by taking this instruction. And this is the third step prayer. It's found on page 63 of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. "God, I offer myself to thee, to build with me and do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. may I do thy will always. Can I get an amen on that?
Amen.
Okay, well, so Larry, tell us, so now you're a veteran. Let's go a little further back, like what happened? Like, okay, so you're a teenager, and all of a sudden you decided
let's go to where I was born. I was born in a town named Defiance, which I always thought was pretty appropriate for how my life was going to be for about the first 48 years. I lived in a lot of Defiance, and I grew up in a small town, though, actually called Deschler. It was about 30 miles from Defiance, and it was a small town, kindergarten, senior high school in the same building. Started to work at 11 years old, pumping gas and cleaning bowling alleys and detasseling corn and that type of thing. And the Vietnam War was going on, and I saw, you know, a lot of young men dying, and I enlisted kind of out of fear and out of lack of academic abilities to get into college at the time. I didn't even really consider college. I wasn't considered college material. So I enlisted in the Air National Guard, and my drinking kind of escalated then. I had drank a lot around home. I grew up in this little German town, and my parents would allow me to drink at home. It was okay if I drank at home. They would rather have me drinking. They always said they'd rather have me drinking at home than out with my friends. But actually, that was a bit naive on their part because they, you know, I was already used to drinking, and so if I'm out with my friends, I wasn't going to change just because I wasn't at home. The military, it kind of picked up drinking. In fact, the military at the time, which was quite different than it is now, drinking was kind of one of the ways we all got together, and you know, a lot of camaraderie and meeting at the clubs after and drinking together and then working hard together.
Sort of a rite of passage?
Sure. And it was. And, you know, I was not one of these guys that had a high tolerance for drinking. Through my whole drinking career, I would get lit up fairly quickly. You know, a couple of drinks, and I had a pretty good buzz. And I could keep drinking for a long period of time. I wasn't a blackout drinker per se, but I did absolutely insane things that I wouldn't remember off the top of my head, but when people would point it out the next day, the things I would do, I would, you know, I would, of course, remember it. And that just kind of followed me all the way through. And I had never, when I got arrested for cocaine possession in 1999, I still disputed that I was alcoholic, which was really kind of crazy. And when I got into it took about 2-3 weeks in rehab before I realized, for it really kind of hit me that, geez, every time I ever got in trouble in my life, every time I had a spat with my wife, or any time I embarrassed my children, alcohol came into play. And it finally hit me that, you know, I was alcoholic way before I ever experimented with drugs. And so that's why, you know, AA has kind of been my choice of 12-step programs, because just because I had so much sobriety there. And do you mind if I throw in just a little Clancy story here?
No, go right ahead.
I was about 3 months sober, and I went to hear Clancy speak with my sister, who was 7 years sober at the time, and this was back in 1999. And he was speaking at the Newport Club in Newport Beach, California. And I was so happy to go there to hear him speak, but he had a real adversity to cell phones, and that was back when not everybody had cell phones like now. And he would actually made the comment, you know, I don't know, all you people carrying those silly phones around, how important you think you are, that you have to stay in contact with everybody. But he says, I'm going to tell you in here, I want you to turn those damn things off. And that was his exact language. So I thought I had mine turned. I turned mine off, stuck it in my pocket. And he gets about 15 minutes into his pitch, and I was only about three rows back, and my phone rings.
Mm-mm.
Now, and I did what any good newcomer would do. I reached in my pocket, and as I was turning it off, I turned around and I stared at the guy sitting behind me like it was his phone.
Oh, that was smart.
And everybody else looked at him, of course, and thought it was his phone. And And Clancy just gave us that evil, that terrible stare. So he really stared me down there. But I've run into him since, and I actually even admitted to him that my phone went off at one of his times and at one of his pitches, and he didn't find it amusing, anyways. But he really carries the torch for Alcoholics Anonymous. I do a lot of meetings down in Australia, and I've been to meetings in New Zealand that they bring up his name a lot. In fact, somebody asked me one time if I was a California atheist, and I said, well, what's a California atheist? And they said, well, that's someone in AA in California that doesn't believe in Clancy.
So, that's funny.
But he you know, he leads one of the biggest meetings in the world. There's a meeting down in Brentwood area that on a Wednesday night, and people dress up for it. I mean, almost every man goes in there has a jacket and a tie on, and there's usually around 900 to 1,000 people at the meeting. It's incredible.
I had a friend of mine that told me about those meetings, and then they direct certain people to speak, and you go up on the platform and all that. You know, well, Clancy's kind of eccentric, you know, because I think part of it is age, or, you know, I like to think of it this way. The rich are usually eccentric. The poor can't afford eccentric. They have to settle for crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
He's got a really good program. I like Clancy. My deal with Rum Radio, that was kind of new, you know, and it's still fairly a new phenomena on the web. And people still have a reluctance to embrace this information, but less and less, I think, because, you know, this is a moneymaker, it's grandiosity, you know, all of that, you know, all that in a bag of chips. But when people see that, it's just nobody knows me in Beijing. And then if you have true purpose, I think it finally will come out. But I like Clancy's, I like his attitude. I like his old stories. He likes to dress up a little bit. But you got to remember his age. He's from several generations back.
Oh, absolutely.
So
yeah.
This world is not his world. He comes from a distant shore, so this is very unfamiliar to him in that sense that people, you know, respect is a big deal. Dressing well is part of recovery to him, and you know, and I agree. I think once you start caring about yourself, your recovery will start getting better. You know, make your bed in the morning and take a shower every day and eat when you're hungry and sleep when you're tired. Basic stuff that a lot of folks miss.
Sure.
So the military was kind of a, you liked the military. You enjoyed the rigors?
Well, I did. And actually the discipline for me, even at 17 going to basic training and at that point in time, to be totally honest, I was midway through puberty. When I went in the military, I was not even shaving. They made me shave in the military. And, I mean, I only weighed like 112 pounds when I went to basic training. And, when I got out of basic training, I'd wear my Air Force uniform if we'd go out to lunch or something from the Air National Guard base in Toledo that I was at. I had people thought I was actually a Boy Scout. So it was a bit embarrassing. I did look pretty young at the time, but you know, I did like the military, and it did give me a good kick in the rear end to get me going. And then I fell in love with watching the airplanes, and that's what really got me at first. We had fighters at the unit there in Toledo, and they'd have air shows where the Blue Angels came in one time, and I remember going, oh my God, I really want to do that. And then I was working in payroll, and I was working with payroll most of the pilots, and I thought they were like the coolest guys on earth. I mean, they had these, you know, different type of uniforms, wearing those flight suits when they would come in, and they went to the front of the shot line, they went to the front of the chow line, and the whole base existed, you know, to service 25 pilots and 25 airplanes. And so I kind of fell in love with the whole thought about being a pilot, but I didn't have any college at the time, and and just for grins, I took the pilot training exam, and I failed it. And so the things weren't looking really well for me, but I just kept trying over and over, and I finally passed the pilot training exam, and I finally got 2 years of college. And the commander, who actually I really liked, he liked me a lot, because usually at certain parties I'd end up riding in the car with him, and we'd go out and we were drinking a lot together. And one night, after some drinking and messing around and rolling around with your buddies on the floor, he came up and kind of picked me up off the floor by my hair, and he said, hey, Smitty, he goes, I'm not going to send any of these college preppers pilot training. He says, I've got one slot, and anybody that drinks as much as you will be a damn good fighter pilot. And and
you're already in the air. You're already up in the air. Now all you need is some controls.
And, you know, he just, it was, I don't know, I was just kind of shell-shocked, but because he had guys that were much more qualified. He had guys with master's degrees, and we all had everything done. We already had the physicals done. We had all passed the testing, but I was the least academically qualified, and then he sent me on to pilot training, and the rest was history. I did okay while I was in pilot training, and I had to do, you had to do well enough to be able to fly fighters. They actually had called me in halfway through, and they said, we don't know if you're going to be good enough to fly fighters. And I said, well, you don't understand. I have to fly fighters because the unit I'm in doesn't have any other airplanes. And so the last part of training, they gave me a really hard instructor, and he was a guy from Texas, by the way, since you guys are over there in Texas, and he just kicked my rear. And then I just took off and did really well through the rest of the program, and the rest was history. And I flew fighters for about 6 years there in Toledo, and then I was got a little cocky. I was doing so well because I'd gotten hired by Braniff Airlines that I thought I didn't need that military stuff anymore. And I quit. And as soon as I quit, I knew I'd made a mistake. But luckily, 3 years later, a C-130 unit up at Selfridge called me up and asked me if I wanted to come up there and fly. So. In the meantime, I'd lost the job at Braniff, and I started selling real estate, so going up and flying even a big old four-engine kind of homely airplane, guys, C-130 pilots will shoot me for saying that, but it's not the best-looking, sleek airplane out there. It's kind of a noisy, vibrating, slow airplane.
I've been on one.
What's that?
I've been on one.
Yeah, well, then you know, yeah. So
yeah,
it's not the glamorous thing, but I loved the crew concept, and we had a ball up there. I was at the Selfridge unit, and I stayed in that airplane until I retired from the military. But, you know, I didn't see the action like so many guys did. And that's why I just salute the people that have been out there, and especially that have been shot at or been injured or you know, and, of course, you know, the guys that have died for us. You know, my heart just always goes out to the families, and I always feel that, you know, I did so little in my time in the service compared to what so many other people did.
Well, my understanding is that for every fellow on the front line, there's 10 in logistics that are providing the service and support to have that one guy out there. So not a lot are going to be on the front line. You're going to have more in a service capacity than actually the combat soldier. That's just the way it is. I mean, if you luck out and you get another job, well, lucky you. If not, it's just... sometimes the way the cards are dealt.
Sure. Well, if I would have been flying a more up to date fighter aircraft, then I was flying the F-100 and then at the end the A-7, I could have seen combat time. But then when I got into the 130, I was flying porta potties over to get
sure.
the Desert Storm and stuff. So I did have some activity with the action going on, but. You know, I look at what the guys went through over in Vietnam, and even over in the desert over there, people shooting at you in an airplane and having pretty powerful missiles and coming zinging at you. That's got to be pretty scary.
Well, the one thing I've noticed, and I was over there and I was in combat, but the stories get larger as you get older.
They should.
Yeah, you catch a lot of fish stories with these guys. You know, you go like, what town were you in? You know, like, what, are you sure about that? Well, it wasn't really 20 guys. It was a kid that was 12 years old.
Yeah.
So, you know, everybody does their part that serves. You know, you just get, you can't delineate that. To me, it's always the difference between the hero and the coward. They kind of go hand in hand. It just depends on the time. I've seen it go both ways. I've seen guys very heroic, and I've seen the same guy cower. So nobody knows for sure how you're going to react when the rubber hits the road. But what I'd like to ask you now, so there was a lot of alcohol consumption in your area. Like, pilots are kind of known for that. You know, people are always concerned about, well, you know, I remember back in the day that when you got on a commercial airliner, it was a concern whether the pilot had been drinking that day. So you found that to be quite the case?
Well, you know, things have really evolved over the years, and it used to be kind of people looked the other way if guys were out drinking the night before. And even when I first got in the airline, I started with Braniff Airlines, and the rule at Braniff was the same as the FAA rule, was 8 hours bottle to throttle. Well, over time, they finally figured out, hey, guys could really drink a lot and really still be screwed up the next day 8 hours later. And so now they've started coming out with much stricter guidelines of what would be acceptable. And basically, if a guy is tested and he blows any amount of alcohol at all, he's not going to fly that day. But anything over, they have different legal limits in different countries, but anything more than just a slight bit will get the guy in some trouble and get him some tension. And then anything over in the United States, anything over a .04, it's a DOT offense, and you're probably going to lose your licenses along with your medical. Anything over a .02, you're going to get some attention, and you're probably going to get an evaluation, but they probably are not going to take your licenses, but they're going to take your medical certificate. So I have a medical certificate, and my experience working with the FAA medical people, they're absolutely wonderful. I mean, they understand addiction is a disease. They look at guys that not with, you know, disdain and that or that deal. Oh my gosh! I mean, because what I did, I was arrested for cocaine possession, and I was, you know, everybody looked at me and called me disgusting and despicable, and a lot of different terms like that. And the truth is, that was who I was. And after I got arrested, no one found me more disgusting than I found myself. I hated myself at that time. And what I know about addiction is I wanted to stop. I tried everything I could humanly possible to stop. And that's why for me, recovery wasn't about my human will. That was never enough to stop drinking or using cocaine. It took a higher power. It took an understanding of it and a spiritual contact and an understanding and having a God consciousness for me to be able to get sober. There are some people that get sober without that, and I'm sure you guys recognize that, but you also recognize, I think, at least listening to you guys, in your own personal life, you recognize that, you know, it's truly a connection with God that gives us the boost to be able to overcome the power of addiction. Because in my life, I'd never met anything more humanly powerful than desire to drink and do drugs.
Well, you had a jumping off point. Was there? Did you come to an agreement? Like, all of a sudden, you just kind of knew that you had enough, or that you were ready?
Oh no,
I got on your knees.
Yeah, February 3rd, 1999. It started out like most nights at my house. I had a refrigerator full of cold beer and some chilled wines, and then I had some, I had a really nice wine rack of wines that you drink warm, and I had a lot of different liquors and scotches and cognacs, and I mean, I thought I was a real classy drinker, and I'd ordered four grams of cocaine from my local drug dealer, who had a motto, I made doze, but I never closed, and he also had a he had a policy: if you called and he didn't deliver within 30 minutes, you'd get a free gram. And he dropped off 4 grams of really fine quality, non-tampered with cocaine. I mean, it was really good stuff that he would deliver. And after he had delivered, I was there for just a few minutes and I just indulged a little bit. And the next thing I know, the police are coming through my door with riot batons and guns and threw me to the floor and put a gun to my head. I actually only had a towel wrapped around me, and that came off on my way down to the floor. And there was about a dozen guys with masks and, like I said, riot batons and shotguns, and they put the gun to my head. And I just could hear them in the background tearing my house apart, busting holes in walls, ripping covered doors off, busting dishes and plates. And they just went crazy, the police did, in my house. And I remember looking up at the police officer, and it was like a different voice, but it was also kind of like what was my higher self. I said, "I'm glad you're here." And I was this is between, you know, the tears and crying and just being just scared out of my mind. And I actually had this acceptance that I'm going to go to prison, but it will be better than living this life of addiction. And I just accepted whatever was going to come my way. I just totally opened up. I didn't hold anything back from the cops. I mean, I'm guilty. What do you want to do? You know, and a couple of days later, when I got out of jail, I went home, and of course, I didn't think I had that much of an alcohol problem. So I opened a really nice bottle of wine, started drinking it. And my dad took the glass of wine out of my hand after a couple of sips and said, "You know, when you go to, you know, you're going to treatment, you probably shouldn't have alcohol in your breath when you get over there." He says, "But when you get home, we'll just drink beer together."
Okay.
And I said, "That's a great idea, Dad." And I had no concept of total abstinence from chemicals. But he took that glass of wine out of my hand, and that was the last drink or intoxicating chemical I ever put in my brain. And I'm living proof that I was stubborn and unknowledgeable and everything there was, but by just going and following some simple directions for a while, it got me enough clarity that I started to be able to look at myself for who I really was. And I actually started realizing I wasn't this person that I hated in addiction, that I was really just suffering from a disease of addiction and alcoholism, and that I can put it into remittance, and I could get it behind me for a while, and I could just do that one day at a time. And after a while, you start chalking up those days. And at some point in time, I like to get to the term where you're unconsciously competent. I mean, it's that in our addictions, we're incompetent, and we're unconscious that we're incompetent. And at some point in time, we start recognizing we have a problem, but we don't do anything about it, so we're still incompetent. And then in this real struggle in recovery, in initial recovery, we're consciously aware that we have to stay sober, and so we do, and we become competent in our lives. We start functioning like normal human beings again. But we got to be on guard all the time. Well, at some point in time, I think, in people's recovery, and I know this has happened to me, was that when things go wrong, my first thought isn't to drink or to use drugs. I've lost both my parents in sobriety. And when my parents died, in both instances, it was, what can I do to be there for my family? What do I have to do now to help out? And while I know I'm going to hurt, I have a grieving process that I have to go through here. And it's okay to cry, and it's okay to be angry, and it's okay to, you know, try to justify it, and all the different grieving, you know, mechanisms that come up. And I was able to get through all that without even considering drinking. Now, I'm not stupid enough to think that I could never consider drinking again, but you get to this point that your life is so wonderful without the chemicals. and the fact that you finally now have a connection with a guy that you really understand, and that you're living life on life's terms. I just don't want to drink anymore. I mean, it's just I don't like it when people in 12-step meetings say, you know, I don't have that option today, drink. And I say, BS, we always have that option. All three of us on this call right now,
sure,
we could make a decision tonight once we get off the air or even during the air to go somewhere and just, you know, pick up a bottle of wine or a bottle of hooch or whatever you want to get and have at it. So the option is always there. It's that I don't care about that option. It's no more than I care about you know, going out and doing brain surgery right now. I just, it's not something that I, it's not in my realm, because that's not who I am now. I'm a sober man, and I like being that way.
Something that you had said, I was really impressed with your cocaine dealer's capitalist entrepreneurship. He, you know, we don't get there in a half an hour. I almost expected it like it would come like in an ice cream truck or something, you know. It was very, that's interesting. What was that, in California?
No, this happened in, I was in Sylvania, Ohio, just a little town outside of Toledo.
In oh, fact, really?
I just got a text from my son. He's listening to us. So, Lucas, hello, and thanks for listening in. I've been on a lot of radio shows, and I don't think he's ever heard me before. So,
oh, there you go. Sure.
So, Lucas, I love you, and I'm proud of you, and there's nothing you can do about it.
You know, these things, if you stop and think about it, I mean, your great-grandchildren could listen to this show sometime down the road or some of the other shows you've been on, if you ever compile them, and you could talk back from them. You know, like,
yeah,
you know, you get to the age.
Some people put that on their, put, you know, some kind of recordings and stuff on their tombstones when they die. I don't know, it might be a little eerie, but yeah, it'd be nice if they could hear it. It's kind of nice. I sure wish my children would have not had to go through my addiction with me, because that's something, that's damage that you do that you can't take back.
Amen.
You know, and I have never minimized in my mind how much I must have hurt that relationship and how much I hurt my sons with my addiction. And, I mean, we can make amends and, you know, verbal amends and saying I'm sorry. Those are just words. And I think it's important that we do that. But, you know, it's living amends that you make after that, and recognizing that, you know, I was human, you know, and I'm not a bad guy. I was a sick guy at one time, and I was guilty of trying alcohol, and I was guilty of trying drugs, and they got to me, and I lost myself in addiction, and you know, I just hope they understand that, and I've been very fortunate that both of my sons aren't drinkers, and as far as I know, they have never done any drugs. And there has never been any evidence of it. They've never had the legal problems and stuff that I had. So I'm very grateful that if anything good came out of my addiction is that my sons saw what a pompous ass I was and don't do that. So,
there you go. Sure. That's a great, you know, that if it saved your children from there. What was that? Remember that song? From Nash, what was his name?
Nash Young or
Graham Nash. Thank you.
Yeah.
We try to live well, teach our children well their father's hell.
We'll fully go by. Yeah, I remember that song.
That sounds like that you've been able to accomplish that. My experience is a little different. I have children that will not forgive me. They will not. And they live with that resentment, and it remains a sadness. But, you know, I have to turn things like that over, even with my children. I've had two daughters die from this disease.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it's like a Greek tragedy kind of thing. And the first daughter who died, it kind of brought the family together, and the second one just blew it apart. It was just like, it was too much. it was just too much, and the recriminations and all the is a sadness. But I have, you know, I have a grandchild that loves me to death, and I was a lousy dad, but I'm a good granddad. So, I have to learn from the program. Sometimes I have to just turn it over to God, and all things will work out in time. You had mentioned about your connection with God. I remember this from Dr. Carl Jung. He was one of the instigators involved in bringing about AA indirectly with Bill W. and Roland Hazard and that whole the history of it. And he wrote this to Bill W. His craving for alcohol was the equivalent on a low level of the spiritual thirst of our being for wholeness, expressed in medieval language, the union with God.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's powerful.
I have that on the website. On the letter was Spiritus Contra Spiritum, which is spirit against the ravages of spirits.
Wow.
And so it's a good little post if you ever get an opportunity to see that.
Yeah, I'll go and see that. And when you say wholeness, that's a Greek word for, sanity is the Greek word for wholeness. And so when we talk about it, the second step, return us to sanity, I always like to think of that I want to be returned to that wholeness of the who I was as a 10 or 11 year old kid, where, before I had really started drinking, I mean, I'd sip beer off my dad's lap and stuff like that, but the innocence, and of the world, and it just, I remember laying out back of our house. It was on the edge of town in Desher, Ohio. It was kind of a farm town. You could hear the moo cows mooing and the chickens in the barns and the stuff. But I'd lay out there in the grass and just look up at the stars and just total wonderment, like, what is up there? But I felt warm that, I was just okay. Everything was fine in my life. I was safe. And, and that all changes as we get in our teens and we get into adulthood, and then we start experimenting with alcohol and drugs and other crazy things, and we get so tainted, and so much of it comes from outside sources. I mean, our school systems and sometimes our parents and our friends that we're so distorted. We're told on so many levels who we are, or what we are really like, and we're graded on everything that we do, and we're evaluated, and you're number 26 out of 30, and you're this and that, and we start to believe the crap that the world tells us about ourselves, and when none of it is true.
Well, over years, I'll tell people, what I've come to the conclusion is some people don't know me and they don't like me. some people get to know me, then they don't like me. It's none of my business what you think of me, because you think so little of me anyway. If not in stature, surely in time.
Well,
I've had to come to the agreement. Most people are so self-involved. They don't really have time. They're not really thinking about me unless I give them a resentment. Now I got free rent. Other than that, I don't really come into most folks' consciousness. So there's no sense considering what they're thinking or not thinking about me. It's just a complete waste of time, and it's an exercise of the ego.
Well, it is, and our egos wants us miserable and it wants us dead. And our egos tell us, my ego constantly tells me I'm more important than I am. And the perfect example of that is when the airline crews, they get in after a long trip, and a lot of times it's international trip, and I'll get into maybe Sydney, Australia, and the people will arm me up, go out to dinner, and sometimes they'll meet in a bar or something. And I'll go down and meet people. And in my early recovery, I was always worried somebody was going to notice I wasn't drinking, so I always would have a glass of something in my hand, usually cranberry juice or something that looked like it could have had alcohol in it, just so people wouldn't bug me about it. And then I'd start to get uncomfortable with people would be drinking, and I'd go, I got to get out of here. So I'd go to the restroom, and then I'd just wouldn't go back, and I'd think, oh, they're all going to miss me, or all they're going to notice that I'm gone. You know? And the next day, you know, you get on the bus to go to the back of the airport, and nobody says a word. You know, nobody missed me at all. They had their party without me. And I was never even, it was never, nobody noticed I wasn't there.
And they wouldn't even notice. Nobody noticed.
So that's when I started realizing my ego was all, you know, it's like thinking people are talking about you, you know. And, I mean, they maybe do sometimes, but most of the time, anytime I think somebody's talking about me or judging me, I'm not even in their thoughts.
Yeah, I've come up with this, that the ego will sacrifice the body on the altar of pride in a vain attempt to stay alive. The preacher said, "Vanity is of vanity. All is vanity. It's all. I might not be much, but I'm all I think about."
Yeah, that's right.
So now your spirituality. Now we know that you know, if you're not in the program, you don't know this, but we've come to the conclusion that our recovery is really based on the understanding of God. Now, some people don't have God of their fathers. Some are we have Buddhists, atheists, agnostics, heathens. All we ask when you first come in is to come to some agreement that you're not the center of the universe. It's not you, that there's something other than you that has more power over you, in the simplest terms. And that's okay. I believe it's a scriptural reference to it. You can't give them meat now. You must give them milk, otherwise they shall perish. So right now, this is Bill W. said, this is spiritual kindergarten. So we come in with simple agreements, like if I have a sponsee that doesn't believe, you know, having a hard time believing in God or a higher power, I said, but prayer is real important. So if you don't know who to pray to, start it off with to whom it may concern. And then we could start building it from there, like kindergarten. You know, you don't have to stay in kindergarten, but we have to start somewhere. So where did your kindergarten, your spiritual kindergarten start?
Well, I grew up, you know, and like I said, in this small town, and I grew up Roman Catholic, and I had a lot of fear because of all the things we were taught in catechism and stuff about sin and mortal sin and all the damnation type thing. Now, I don't mean to put down the Catholic Church in any way. In fact, I still respect the Catholic Church. It's still on my dog tags from the military. I'm Roman Catholic, and that's the only church I was ever baptized in. But you know, I've come to believe that, you know, there's things that don't seem to fit for me, and they fit well for other people. A lot of my closest best friends, even not in the recovery, are still Catholic, and they'll tease me once in a while, you know, because I'm not on board with them as much. But in my recovery, and it was really amazing to me, and how I felt so connected with God is, you know, that, you know, God really wants me to be happy, joyous, and free. And so a lot of the stuff I've studied and worked on in my recovery is based with that premise, is that not only is happiness something I want, but happiness is my function. And if I'm happy, then I'm probably doing God's work. And I get a lot of the spiritual materials from not just 12-step meetings, but a book called A Course of Miracles, which is written a lot like AA. I heard one guy say one time it doesn't correlate with AA. It's identical to AA in that the book is written in past tense, and it's like, you know, the first step, it says, we were powerless over alcohol, and our lives became unmanageable. So that's all past tense. You know, and the 12th step, you know, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps.
Yeah.
See, it was written in the past, and A Course of Miracles is written like that. And what I like about when I really investigate A Course in Miracles, or if I just dissect 12 steps in my head, is that I think some people interpret it different than me. Some people interpret the first step is that we are still so sick and we're still so powerless that, you know, that's how we will always be. I don't look at alcohol having any power in my life whatsoever today because I don't drink it.
Right.
I'm not foolish enough to think that if I picked up a drink, I could control it. I know I can't. I have proven that thousands of times. But, you know, as a result, having that 12th step, having had a spiritual awakening, having achieved the goal of working the 12 steps, and that's what I always point out to my sponsees when I work with them, or people in when I work in programs that have that are truly work 12 steps, is there's a goal with these 12 steps, and it's to have a spiritual awakening, which is, you know, learning about your higher self, or learning of having the awareness of a conscious contact of the God in your life, and having an open communication channel, which means the communications comes both ways. But for me, it actually means it comes mostly from him to me, because there isn't anything that God doesn't know about me already, and I don't have to ask for what I want. He knows what I want, and me asking for it doesn't reinforce whether he's going to give it or not, the way I look at it. But, you know, having had it, you know, with the first step is, since we were powerless over alcohol, that tells me that, you know, we get past that powerless state. And I know I have friends in 12-step meetings. They get mad at me if I even say, you know, I'm not powerless over alcohol. I said, that's what the first step tells me, that people that work this program are that way. And they're going, no, you're still powerless. Well, if I was powerless over it, I'd be drinking right now.
I hate when the semantics come in and people try to nitpick that stuff. You know, you're going to say what you're going to say, you try to explain what you mean, and then you let it go.
Yeah, you know, and if whatever is working for you is what should work for you, and whatever works for me, you know, I've stayed sober, coming, you know, I don't have it right in front of me right now, but, you know, 13 and three-quarters years, I think, right now, and, you know, what I'm doing is working for me, and I don't want to say I'm not going to change it, because I'm always changing it. Because I'm always evolving as a person. Some ways I'm losing some memory with my age, and I'm losing a few steps on a few things. But, you know, I think with age we do start acquiring some wisdom by just the fact that we got through all this stuff and we're still breathing at our age. And my wisdom, you know, is that, you know, I love this, having that monkey of alcoholism and cocaine off my back. It was there. It made every decision for me for a period of years that I can't even count how many. You know, I spent thousands and thousands of dollars, and I can't, you know, up my nose or down my gut. And, you know, I just don't live like that today. And it's a conscious choice. My faith in God is a conscious decision. It isn't that I understand God. It's that I have a faith that there's something out there that's a better connection than what I have. And you know, it was funny. I was at a seminar all weekend, and a guy says, well, if somebody asks me if I'm Christian, I say yes. And he goes, and if they ask me if I'm Jewish, I say yes. He says, if they ask me if I'm Buddhist, I say yes. and you know, the thing is we all have to remember, and watching the whole political stuff the last few weeks almost drove me crazy, because everybody thinks that everybody should think the way they do, and there is it, which is so impossible, because all of our DNA is different, every experience we've had in life is different, and so we get to a certain point and our belief system is based on what's happened to us and our DNA, and then what we chose to learn about. So one of the things in recovery, you know, before we get here, what I chose to learn about was, you know, what I thought was good beer, good wine, good whiskey, and then good drugs. And at some point in time, that didn't work anymore, so I had to choose to learn about something else. So I chose to learn about recovery. And I also chose to learn about a lot about the neuroscience of addiction, because it was, how in the hell did I end up like that? How did I end up nagging on my kitchen floor with a gun to my head? I grew up in this nice little town with nice parents and nice sisters and good friends, and I end up almost dead. So, I just, you know, I get really excited and passionate about recovery because it is, it's about changing your life and shifting your values and reinventing how you live every minute of your day, from the time you get up in the morning to the time you go to bed at night. It's 100% different. I don't do anything that I used to do in 1999. It's all different.
Right. I like to think of it this way, that the monkey might be off my back, but the circus is still in town.
Well, the crazy thinking is still there. I mean, and I can still be angry, and I still get angry a lot, and I still get frustrated a lot, and I still have very strong opinions about things, and that's never changed. And but I do understand other people. I do try to respect other people. So
the way I look at it is, we're powerless over alcohol until we've worked an honest 12 steps. Once we've worked the 12 steps, we're not powerless anymore.
Right.
Now, that doesn't mean we're not going to drink again. It just means that now I have a decision I can make, and prior to that, I didn't have the ability to make that decision. I believe that's the difference. That makes the difference. But, you know, that's me. Harold, I'm sorry. I should have invited Jan. Did you have anything you wanted to ask Larry if you're still there?
Well, I am here, and I missed part of the conversation. It's so ironic that some of my family therapy involves young people that are having a rough time with drugs, and the parents are trying to influence them to go into treatment. And a call came in, so I went ahead and took the call, try to help with a little bit of a crisis this evening. But I came back and really have enjoyed listening to the conversation, especially about spirituality and how to fit in different places. Indeed, I've had experience along the same lines, studying various religions from all over the world and studying science. And I think what's happened recently in the last 10 or 15 years is that the science of archaeology has advanced to the point where they've made some discoveries that are really changing the accuracy or the views about the Bible, and whether it's a storybook or whether it's actually scientifically provable.
Yeah.
And that's the topic for an entire other program. I've been looking at the Bible differently, and for about the past dozen years, and I love talking about that. It's really, really important. The main focus for me was the prophecies and how they, how we, through archaeology, we've learned that just how accurate they were, right down to the day. But this has been a great conversation about recovery and working with others, and I hope Larry will come back and be on the program again.
Oh, I'd love to. Thank you.
You know, I was telling Larry earlier before we got on that 1,000 years from now, the anthropologist will be concluding that our society communed with an all-knowing God named Google. what I found, Harold was an atheist when he came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and if you can hear now, he's a avid and fervent disciple of Jesus Christ, which will give you an idea. That's the way his growing. In the big book it says, our sobriety is contingent upon the maintenance of a daily spiritual condition. But my take on it is, what maintains itself of itself? And I have found nothing does that. You're either growing spiritually or you're declining spiritually. And if you're declining spiritually, your sobriety, your recovery, and even your sobriety becomes tentative. So we're expected to continue to grow in a spiritual form, and that the beginning of AA is kindergarten and just the beginning. What I'd like to take a few minutes, though, and hear about Get Real Recovery.
Oh, well, I'd love to talk about that. My wife and I, we both became certified counselors years ago. She worked in the mental health field, and we actually met at an AA meeting, and after 9 years of courtship, we finally got married a year ago, and it'll be our anniversary in 11 days. And about 2 years ago, the place she was working as a counselor went bankrupt and went up in smoke kind of overnight, and she volunteered to stay around and help with the patients that were still there without being paid for a few months. And then she got a lot of job offers because she's just a wonderful, wonderful counselor. And I said, you know, have you ever, we had talked, I've mentioned it before, and she wasn't interested. I said, do you have any interest in opening, you know, our own place? And she says, well, I don't want to own an inpatient program because you're married to it 24/7. And she goes, she knows that she burns out very, you know, this field, if you're working in it as a counseling professional, that is quite a bit different than what we do as sponsorship. I mean, it's
right. Oh yeah, yeah.
We look at things like different. We consider ourselves a 12-step program, but we don't try to replace what AA or NA or any of the 12-step programs do. We encourage them, but we look more at the cognitive behavioral therapy side, in that we need to change our thinking and we need to change our thought processes and our belief systems and basically institute new values based, you know, on in our recovery. And she says she would be open to opening an outpatient. I said, well, that's all I'd like to do too, because I've been researching it and found that outpatients sometimes can be, at, you know, even more valuable for people than going to inpatient. Because first of all, we can do the treatment a lot cheaper. Number two, people aren't getting locked up in a residential home somewhere or in a hospital as they do an inpatient, and then they live there for 30 or 60 days, and then they let them out, and then they're just shell-shocked when they get back into the world. By going to outpatient, they're still in their own world, they're still in an environment, they're still around all the temptations and evils of addiction and that are out there. So there's no big shock when people get done with intensive outpatient. I mean,
yeah, I agree.
And so, and also, you know, pilots have always had this really high recovery rate, and there's a lot of people have different excuses for it or different reasons for it. But I've always said the reason pilots have such a high recovery rate is they're required to be monitored for long periods of time, for years. And outpatient affords that. People can go to outpatient, and then what we do is we have 4 days a week, 3 hours a day of intensive outpatient, and then people will step down, and they'll maybe cut back to 1 or 2 days a week, and then they'll start coming in the evenings to an aftercare program. And we like to have them stay around indefinitely. I mean, we monitor a lot of pilots in our program that either need aftercare for the program that they're in for their airline, or some pilots don't have airlines, and we do the aftercare for them and the monitoring for them for the FAA. And my wife just does a fabulous job. We work with all kinds of life skills stuff, all the relapse prevention categories, personal boundaries, denial, self-sabotaging behaviors, communication skills, anger and stress management. I do a lot of groups on neuroscience of addiction, and I do some stuff. I do a group on happiness. I do a group on personal finances and recovery. So we work with people all ages and all backgrounds and all addictions, and even people with dual diagnosis with other diagnoses of depression or even some of the more serious ones. And we do a great job with them, and they're with us as long as they need to be. And we are very flexible on scheduling, and we work with people to make sure they can afford to get the help they need. And we point them in a lot of directions, and we try to encourage them to, you know, the younger people to get, you know, do volunteer work and then get a recovery job.
How would I get a hold of you now? So it's Get Real Recovery.
Yes. Let me give you my website and my phone number. The website is GetRealRecoveryInc.com. So our name of our company is Get Real Recovery Inc., as in incorporated, INC.com. And my number is 949-933-2505.
Give it again, would you please? Most people need at least one or two.
Okay, I'll give it to you in aviation terms. 949 933-2505.
Okay, some people, you know, it usually take it a couple of times. So it's Get Real Recovery.
Sure, sure. Well, it's GetRealRecoveryInc.com. Both my number's on there, Lori's number's on there, full explanation of the program. A lot of the monthly articles that I write for different publications are on there. And it's a good overview of our program and of our facility. The thing that we decided on is we know that large groups are not effective. That too many people goof off if they're in large groups. They can hide under the radar. They can only certain people seem to get attention all the time. Our groups are on average have 3 to 4 people in them, and so everybody gets a lot of attention. And we don't have discipline problems. We don't have chaos. We don't have people interrupting the groups and pulling people out to go take a pill or to go see a nurse or go see a doctor. They come to us. They get focused, meaningful care, and, you know, in a loving, firm way. We just don't mess around. We have just had amazing results because we stay with the principles that we learned in AA, but we actually do the cognitive behavioral therapy needed to get people to get their lives turned around. And we rarely have trouble getting people to go to 12-step meetings. Once in a while, we'll get people who will go through, they'll stay sober, and they won't be going to 12-step meetings. We always hope that they'll get the message after, but we don't force people to go to 12-step meetings or do anything. Everything's it's an adult program with adult solutions.
Yeah, I don't go for the force thing. I think the recovery, the cornerstone of recovery is either you'd call it agency or free will. It's on, you know, the big book says this book is only meant to be suggestive. We know so very little. More shall be disclosed to both you and to us. So it's a statement of humility that, you know, there's other ways to skin that cat. We don't know it all. More will be disclosed. Be quick to see where religious people are right or wrong, or someone else. Keep an open mind. Do not have contemporary investigation. Don't look at the person. Look at the principle. These are all in the big book because this is who the alcoholic and addict is.
Mm-hmm.
I tell people you could tell a drunk. You could tell an alcoholic anything, you just can't tell him much. So, and I also wanted to know about, you did something with journal. You did a journal?
I wrote a book a few years ago. I was noticing that people didn't have many skills as far as goal setting, and then some people, we always talk about journaling. We know journaling is very effective in recovery, but when I first started trying to journal, I couldn't get anything on the page, and so I devised a little scheme where you could just draw a line on a gauge to measure certain areas in your life, like your attitude and your energy level and your motivation and your spiritual connection and your personal boundaries, and these type of areas, you just draw lines on a gauge to self-assess how am I feeling right now. Because this constant daily self-assessment, especially in early recovery, is very important. So you can catch yourself when you start sliding down the proverbial relapse tube. You pick it up early, and then you can take action. Instead of waiting until you're sitting in the bar in front of the drink, or you've already called your drug dealer and he's on the way over, you'll give you a little more of a heads up. So it's about setting goals and determining what's important in your life, and then where do you want to be with those things, and bringing everything back to the present moment, and then self-assessing daily on where we are with things. And the name of the book is Captain Larry Smith's Daily Life Plan Journal. And the best way to get a copy is just give me a call, and we'll work it out over the phone because I can get it to you. I have a lot of copies. I bought a lot of copies, so I can just send it to you cheaper than you can buy it online if you're interested in it. And I actually do workshops with it. Pardon?
Can I buy it online?
You can buy it online, and actually I have a website. It's www.CaptainLarrySmith.com, and you can just click on it from there and buy it online, or you can give me a call and I can mail you one.
So you don't have Amazon or anything like that, no?
It goes through, if you click on it on CaptainLarrySmith.com, it will go through Lulu.com is the online publisher.
Okay.
So I self-published it through them. And
I'm
working on a couple, on revising it, adding to it, and changing the book a little bit, and maybe writing my memoirs again, because I have some of those have been published in different, you know, in short form in different books. I'm working on the best way to get my message out the message recovery out, and also kind of the highlights of my story, because I want people to realize addiction can happen to anybody at any time, and that and recovery can happen to anybody that has addiction.
Excellent. You know, one thing I wanted to mention, I forgot earlier, was that you're outpatient. One of the arguments I have with inpatient is I believe it kind of builds up demand. You know, when you're sequestered in a location and you haven't had a drink or a drug in 28 days, all of a sudden you're free and forbidden fruit that's been denied you all that time, I think it builds up. There's a hidden, you know, now you're back in the world, now you're free to go do your thing, and that's pretty heady. So
it is. I remember, actually, Joseph, I remember the day I got out of treatment. I had 47 days sober, and I was supposed to drive to Sober Living, and my sister dropped off a truck for me, and I got in that truck, and I only had to drive about a half mile down the road to go to my Sober Living home, and my head went right to, when I pulled in this treatment place, you know, 30-some days ago, there was a 7-Eleven down the street there, and I know they sell booze, and my head said I could run down there, pound down a couple beers real quick, you know, brush my teeth real quick, do some Listerine or something, rinse my mouth, and show up at Sober Living, and nobody will know the difference. And
one
that,
of us.
I mean, I had every. Now listen. I'm facing 5 years in prison. I'm going to lose pretty good airline job gig that I have going if I do this. I've embarrassed my kids. I have every reason in the world not to drink, and my brain, after even being clean for 47 days, said, oh, you could just go do it one more time. And so that's what tells me how powerful alcohol is, because it just didn't – I convinced myself not to do it because I remember somebody saying the day before, you know, all you got to do is get through the day. And I went, all I got to do is get through today and I'll be okay. And if I want to drink tomorrow, I'll drink tomorrow. Well, they, like there used to be a little kid's book that said tomorrow never comes. And I like that because, you know, the little kid wakes up every day and runs in and, hey, Mommy, is this tomorrow? She goes, no, tomorrow's tomorrow. This is today. So the next day he runs in again today. He goes, is it tomorrow yet? Well, that's kind of how I think about my drinking. I'll drink tomorrow, but just not today.
Just not today. Well, thank you, Larry. Well, I think we'll close it up with Harold. Did you have any last words?
No, it's a great program, and I really give thanks to God for every day of my sobriety.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Larry, for your time and for all the work you do. I hope this was a help for you getting the word out on Get Real Recovery. I think that's real important. I think the outpatient is a great idea. No sense sequestering anybody. You got to want it.
That's true.
It's not about, you know, I tell people, and of course, you know, you get 15 alcoholics in a room, you're going to get 20 opinions. But my deal is that AA is for people who want it, not for people who just need it. If we filled the rooms with people who needed it, there wouldn't be room for the chairs.
That's
so
that's,
You gotta want this thing, otherwise you're not ready, and that's why we have to be beaten into a state of reasonableness. Well, thanks everybody for listening. I think you'll get a lot out of this, or at least some. I did. Kept me sober another day. So hey, you know, look, that's good enough sometimes.
Yeah, Harold and Joseph, both. I want to thank you guys both for having me on, and thank you for the work you're doing.
Oh, you're
thanks,
quite
Larry.
I want to give that plug on Rum Radio. We're in 145 foreign countries, including Mississippi, approaching 2,600 towns, cities, and villages. And we just went over 181,000 hits to the website. That's since our inception, September 10th, 2009. So we're a little over 3 years. We're growing. We're averaging between 500 and 600 hits a day all over the world. And we're the busiest in Beijing, China. Why Beijing? I haven't got a clue. I think because the site has a spiritual lilt to it, and they might have been deprived so long from spirituality that it's like dripping water on a sponge. But other than that, it's only my best guess, which might not have anything to do with anything. So thanks, guys, again. And remember, we'll see you on the radio, rumradio.org. Good night.
Good night.